Welcome to the Danny Carlson Podcast, your resource for growing the business and mindset for a life of unrestricted freedom. Now here's your host, online marketing acrobat, Danny Carlson.
What's up, guys? Danny Carlson with the Danny Carlson Podcast here, and we have an in-person interview here in Bali, a couple hundred meters from the beach, and this is going to be a really interesting one, I think. I don't think I've ever really sat down and dove into someone who is 12 years into a big, potentially world-changing company like you were doing right now, and I'm sure you have gone through all sorts of craziness throughout those 12 years and getting to the point where you're at now, but maybe a good place to start is, what was one of those super crazy moments along the journey in the 12 years where maybe the company almost exploded, or you just almost gave up, or maybe you did give up at some point and then came back to it? Like, what is something that comes to mind?
Yeah, hi Danny, and thank you for having me on your program. It actually did, we did have a major turning point in Bali, and this is how we ended up here. You know, it was a little bit by accident. You know, Bali is not really known for tech startups. You have a lot of digital nomads here, but we run real laboratories and everything else. And that's rather unusual for Bali, right? So, but we had a moment about 14 months ago. Our company, we had just won most innovative energy generation company in the world by Fast Company. We had a special on CNN. Our net worth was going up, you know, to multiple hundreds of million dollars. And one of our investors actually figured out he could do it better himself. So he tried to take over the company. And we're sitting here stranded with like two or three people, pretty much out of money ourselves, because I never paid myself. So all I had was like my corporate credit card I could live off. And the moment that was cut off, you know, we knew we were going to have a really tough time. So about almost now a year and a half ago, we're sitting in Bali, and this is how we ended up here. And I had to make the decision if I wanted to keep on pushing with this dream of building small-scale waste to energy generators that could potentially revolutionize how power is generated and waste is treated in rural areas like in Africa, Southeast Asia, for example, or if I'm going to go home or do something totally different with my life. So this was like a big turning point, and we literally sat here only about, you know, maybe 500 feet from here in a hotel and said, what the f*** are we going to do now, right? Company had to shut down, had to be totally restructured, no money in the bank, three people stuck in the hotel, wife pregnant.
And just to add to it,
just a little bit of pressure, you know, like 3 days left on the credit card, we could have paid the hotel. And so making that decision and said, you know, are we willing to move on? Are we willing to battle on? How are we going to go from here? And I've raised a lot of money, lost a lot of money at that point then, obviously. So where do you go from here? And I made the decision for myself to keep going back to raising money. And actually that Friday, it was clear that the company would be restructured. I raised new money by Monday. And completely took this as an opportunity to now build a company how I wanted the company to be, right? No sacrifices, stay true to my own vision, stay true to my own course, and build something that was much leaner and much stronger than what we had before. But it was exactly a pertinent turning point here in Bali, a few hundred feet from here. A chance to really turn lemons into lemonade and a total disaster to something very positive ultimately.
And so what were some of the ways that you restructured the company? And I mean, that's a fast turnaround to go from being like, okay, the company is done, to now we have some new investors and we're switching things there.
Yeah, the first thing was a mindset. I mean, I was never really attached to like my valuation and everything else, because on paper that day, I went from like 120 million net worth to like minus 20. Because I literally signed personally the last investment deal we did, I personally guaranteed. So I knew there was like, I had like absolutely nothing left. I wasn't just broke. I was minus 20 million at that point, which is quite a lot of money to lose in one day. But
I'd say
I never really focused on the loss of that day. I literally turned around and I called my closest friends and my closest strategic partner and said, listen, this is an amazing opportunity. Right? We have just given the key to build an even better company than before, without all the debt, without all the overhead, with all the mistakes we have done in the past. We can do this clean, we can do this better, and we can create a better upside. And I had no time to like be negative. I had to go forward, be positive, and turn that opportunity into something real. And the most important thing is to convince people that have the money to support you in that moment, right? And for them not to be scared about, wow, I've just lost all my investment in your company, but say, this is an opportunity to move forward. We want to do something. So I had to go back and raised about 350,000, 400,000 euros by Monday. So it was 48 hours on the phone, literally just walking up and down the pool, trying to sell the past issues, but at the same time looking forward and finding the support from people who trust me, that believe in my vision, that believe in the technology, to now not give up. But again, take this as an opportunity and not as a disaster.
And what was it, do you think, that allowed you to really see things that way? Because I think most people in that situation, they instantly go to net worth of negative $20 million overnight, probably freaking out and just like incredibly stressed to the point where I think a lot of people would really struggle to get on a phone with a potential investor and hold it together, let alone actually successfully convince them that this is a great opportunity and they should invest in it, right? So like, what do you think it was for you that made you do that? Was it just like your resilient mindset that you developed, or was it a certain technique that you used to calm yourself? Like, what do you think it was?
I think, and I teach classes now about this exactly because I see a lot of people in that moment that literally would have jumped off a roof. You know, if you have burned through $130 million and you're broke and everything is gone and you just lost your company, it's a good moment to jump off a roof. Now in Bali, we don't have, you know, like two-story buildings. Most buildings are simply not tall enough to do that, to cause serious damage. You really have to be very selective. But it just really never occurred to me. I mean, I was always very critical of my own company. So I knew that we had legacy risk, that someone have skeletons in the closet, that the spending, you know, it was... With every investor, we needed new reporting, everything. The spending had gotten out of control. And so I did feel that we had a need to restructure ourselves, but I couldn't have done it from the inside. I could only do it from the outside. And the second thing is that I was never really attached to the money to begin with. I never made money with a startup. So I did this thing truly. I was stuck in Africa, you know, almost a decade ago. And I woke up this one morning, and I really like to tell the story because actually it's true. And I had terrible food poisoning. And I was working for the German government in a place called Awassa in Ethiopia, which is very rural Ethiopia at that point. And I woke up in the morning, you know, it was pitch black. It was like 2 o'clock. There was no moon or nothing. I was trying to get to the toilet and nothing worked. I couldn't switch my light on. I couldn't switch my mobile phone on. So I literally just had to crawl through the roaches and everything else to this one public toilet, which I shared pretty much with the entire village, where I then finally passed out. And I was like, this is so shitty. And it's all based on, you know, in such wealthy countries, they have so much sunshine, so much biomass, so much waste, but they can't keep the lights on, right? So my vision was truly getting a machine that I thought was going to solve a problem, that's going to make an impact. And I thought German engineering could really do that. But I never got into it, you know, for the money reason. I never got into it to, you know, own cars, something like that. So for me, my situation, I didn't own any cars before. I didn't have an apartment. I was a digital nomad for the last 25 years. I have 2 suitcases. I have like 3 black shirts and 2 black suits. And so I didn't lose anything in that moment. Like, because I still had my vision. I still had my drive. I still had the people who supported me. So the important things, I think, in my life were still intact. And that's what gave me the resilience to push on and completely rebuild this company from scratch, even though now having somebody that has, you know, hundreds of million euros working against me.
Yeah, well, and that's not an easy mindset to get into. I'm curious if you have some sort of spiritual practice or meditation or something like that, because what you're mentioning, like the non-attachment and everything like that, is it's a spiritual teaching, it's a spiritual practice, right? And I think that is one of the hardest things for a lot of entrepreneurs or people who get into anything to make a lot of money, or that could make a lot of money, is detaching from the result of my self-worth is tied to this amount of money that I have made or that I want to make or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's literally making a difference between being successful and being happy. You know, the two things don't, at least in my mindset, don't necessarily have a lot in common, because when I lived in Silicon Valley or Los Angeles or London, I see a lot of people who are incredibly successful, but they're also incredibly unhappy. So when I reach when I reach 40, and it's so, you know, typical, you know, as some people call like midlife crisis. But when I looked at my life when I was 40, I was literally on top of my game. You know, it raised over 100 million at that point. I had great articles, were winning awards. Everybody was like, you know, your life is amazing. And my life wasn't amazing at all. I mean, at that point, I was literally just trying to, you know, drink myself to death as quickly as possible. And then at 40, I really had to do a turnaround and look after myself. I moved myself to the Caribbean, detox for a few months, still drink a lot, but I mean, not now I do it for fun and not you know, to kind of hurt myself. So I kind of had that moment already previously in my life where I had to make the decision, do I want to be what's important to me? And I made the decision that for me it's important to be happy, not necessarily be successful. If I can be successful at the same time, great, but it's not the driving factor. The other thing that's strange about me, I'm probably the only person on Bali, I don't really meditate, I don't surf, I don't take a lot of time for myself, I'm not overly deeply spiritual in any way, I'm really kind of a shallow person, right? I like to eat well, I love to sing, I love to, can I say that? I don't know what.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's got to speak the truth in that.
So, I mean, I'm really rather simple guy. I like to party. I have an amazing young family. I have an amazing wife. So, like, I was thinking, so, you know, you think back, like, all those things that you have been told over the last, 25 years I've been in business was that, like, your taste changes in life or, like, the things that you want for in your life. For myself, I figured out, I moved to Italy when I was 17, I lived in southern Italy, and that's what I did. I played the guitar, I sang, I met beautiful women, I went to the beach, I ate great food. And ultimately, 25 years later, it still was driving me and what matters to me. So as long as I can still do that, and Bali is an amazing place for that, because it needs a fraction of the money to have this kind of lifestyle here than you would maybe in Southern California, for example, I'm fine. Right, and the rest is a bonus, and I know I'll always make some kind of money because I'm an incredible sales guy, so I can sell just about anything if I wanted to, but I don't want to. And so I felt secure, I felt things were going to be fine, and this mixture out of being content with what I have and having a clear, fresh focus on what is possible, I think kind of got me through this period without meditating on what I wanted to do. It's really just what's driving me. I said, we're so far with our technology, right? We're building projects in India now that's supposed to be make a difference to 25 million people in India that live in dire poverty in rural parts. Do this with Tata and Rockefeller Foundation, for example. It's like, we're so far now technically, we just can't stop. It would be ridiculous now to stop, because somebody else who wants to do the same thing is going to have to go through the whole learning curve again. It's going to take them again 12, 15 years to get the point. If they're lucky where we are right now, so nobody's going to do it. So we just simply have to finish this thing up, and then we can decide what we do afterwards.
Yeah, well, and I love that you shared too that like a big driver for you was the pain of having to go through that entire breakdown with alcohol and everything like that. And I think that the most powerful realizations for myself and for a lot of other people is when you hit that rock bottom, when you hit that moment, right? Like those are the things you can carry through to get you through those situations, like that getting negative $20 million overnight and just really see what matters in that scenario. It's not the fact that you lost a bunch of money or things are not going good financially. It's you can just see it for what it is and move forward with that. But you're also someone who's, from the sounds of it, very driven by philanthropic, like very life-changing positive things for the world, right? And I mean, obviously your company is doing something that's very related to that. What really is the key motivator for you on that side? Like, what kind of change do you want to manifest in the world with your company?
Yeah, I mean, I think I got lucky to a certain extent, because I'm like third generation from a little bit of money in Europe. So like, we don't have a lot of money, but my mother was very, very successful in her political career. And so I feel very honored, that I'm in a position, like even when I was a teenager, I could decide what I wanted to do, right? I was not like in many countries. I've been on the road for 25 years, so I've been to many countries where people simply didn't have the choice back then to decide what they wanted to do. They mainly had to focus on making money. I was at a point where, I pretty much could have done anything and my parents would have supported me then. So I initially became a singer, actually. I spent 8 years on the road as an opera singer.
Opera
musical theater. So again, something that forced me to work very different, because if you're a performer or an athlete, you're used to being abused and failing every single day. Right? If you're an opera singer and you have a certain role to sing and there are 12 different high notes, you're going to hammer those things thousands of times and you're going to fail at it hundreds and hundreds and thousands of times until you get it right. The same as an athlete would do. So I think you have more resilience built in your mindset. Failing on a daily basis is part of what you do. It's not anything special. You just know that you just haven't done it enough in order to succeed at it. So I think that's something that really, it changed my mindset. And it also gave me like the chance then when I left music and I wanted to do something in business, that I could really focus on doing something meaningful. by the time now everybody's into sustainability and impact. But when I started this, you know, 15, 16 years ago, that was not such a big thing. It was actually very rare. But money wasn't driving me. I come a little bit from a hippie background, as I said. So I could do something where I really thought it was going to make an impact. And I could be very, very picky about what I wanted to spend my limited lifetime with. And I chose that kind of, you see it here, all the plastic waste we have, for example, right? That there's, if I can be remembered for simply solving that one solution, that's what I spend my entire life on, I think I'll be fine with that. You know, I'll die pretty happy. I've achieved what I wanted to do. Waste in general doesn't treat itself. So I love it here. You know, people clean up the beach and they feel very great about themselves and they really should do it. But all it does is, like, you know, they give it to somebody else. It's going to dump it back into the river and it's going to end up on the ocean. Like, if you really want to do it different in waste and energy, you need to have a lot of really smart people. You have a lot of great engineers. Otherwise, you always run the risk of creating more problems than solutions. You know, if you have terrible emissions, for example, you know. So you need a lot of smart people. Waste is not going to treat itself. And if, like, my position is to get these geniuses together until they come up with a real working worldwide solution, then I think I'm happy with all the choices I've made in my life, and the sacrifices and the battling on the way was worth doing it, because somebody has to do it. So if it's me, I'm fine. I can take quite a lot. I just figured that one out.
Yeah, well, I mean, you certainly proved that. And I think personally that if you are working on something you don't really believe in that much, then you're probably not going to see it through all of the really crazy times. Like that time when you're, you know, you had to pick up the phone and raise 300 grand by Monday. That'd be pretty hard if it was like some insurance company that you didn't give a shit about. And like you really care about it that much to go through something like that and just keep going, yeah. Right? Probably not. And in order to really change the world, I think it takes people like you who are just so dedicated to something to actually see it through. Like, you're 12 years into this right now and still going, right? It's yeah, still a continuous
almost thing. Almost restarting. It's like almost we're back to, you know, point zero. We're back in the laboratory. We're back doing emission testing, all these things that cost money. And it's very, very tedious in this industry. We're back to hiring and training new engineers for the, I don't know how many times, but it's an ongoing process. But you're absolutely right. Is that, so when I teach classes now to entrepreneurs that come to me and ask me, so why did you stick around? Why are you still doing this thing? You could be selling real estate or something like that, you know, or you said you could be selling insurances or something like that. And I know that there are a lot of great businesses out there that people just make purely for, you know, the reason of making money, of making a living. And I don't know much about that. I've never done that in my life. If I tried to do something for money reasons, it was always terribly unsuccessful, to be quite honest. But I do believe that one way you can go through these obstacles and you can build this resilience is building a very clear vision of what you want to do, what you want to achieve, and why you want to do it, and telling everybody about it so they're going to judge you by it. I've been, you know, talking like a broken record for the last decade. But, I mean, the challenges that we have really have not changed. We have, you know, we had the waste issues and the energy issues back then. Now we have climate change on top of that. So we are really have many reasons to stay focused and keep doing what we're doing. And that's what I try to help other entrepreneurs with. And I really to be very clear about their vision, how to communicate it, to stay true to it when things get really, really rough. And I come out of an industry, like when you say things blow up, like for us, literally things blow up. Like we had a 16 million euro prototype that we built in Germany. And we were owned by Kleiner Perkins at that point, one of our first investors on the technology side from the US. And Al Gore was flown over to see our prototype. And it literally blew up in the next 3 days.
Well, it exploded. It
internally, exploded. Nobody got hurt. But to that point where that machine never ran again. It took 3 years to build, 16 million in cost. And it was shattered within 200 hours of operation. And what did we have to say back then? Let's do the same thing again in Italy. Spend twice the amount of money, make the system twice as big. And back then it only lasted for a week. So, you know, again, we blew the whole thing up. You know, it broke. You spend so much money on this thing until you really figure out how it works. And you always have to go back to investors and say, well, you know, so we built this thing to the best of our ability. It looked great in our simulation. I don't know what happened. Boom. But so when people say you burn money and you blow things up, we literally burn money and blow things up. That's how it feels.
That is a true resilient entrepreneur there. And I do love, I mean, you really embody the whole resilient entrepreneur like that. I think that's a great title for what you're doing with the teaching things. What are some other things that you talk to younger entrepreneurs to really inspire that mental attitude in them and inspire them to do similar things?
I try to be as personal with them as possible, because that's the one thing. I just started teaching like 3-4 months ago also too, and I don't really, it's like more communicating. I'm working on a book called The Resilient Entrepreneur, and I thought I was going to be one of these guys where you read, I write a book in a day or I write a book in 2 days. I'm somehow incapable of doing anything like this. So now, then it was like 2 weeks, then it was 2 months, probably going to be 2 years until I'm done with it. But what I really found with it was, for me, it was a lack when I was in the situation of running a very fast-growing startup. I didn't really have anyone to relate to. I didn't really have anybody to talk to anymore because I was only surrounded with people at some point that I worked with, or that worked for me, or that I wanted something from. Like, I had no more social infrastructure whatsoever. I only had people that, you know, literally wanted something from me or vice versa. And so I just try to be very personal with people. I try to understand what really drives them, make it more about them and not myself. I know myself quite well, what drives me. But listen to them and see where they stand, you know, giving them an understanding of maybe what might be coming up in the future. And it's so individual what startups people should be building. It's so much based on your personality. So I try not to be so broad as many friends of mine when they talk about entrepreneurship, where, you know, there's like one kind of entrepreneur. I think there are many different kinds. And to find the right balance between what is important to you and building the company that really serves you and makes you happy and makes an impact at the same time, it's just so individual for everybody. And so I spend a lot of time talking with people, very individual, no matter if they're doing a coaching business or a tech startup. I think the business needs to fit what that person really wants in life. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to stick with it long enough to see it through. Most startups, you know, everybody likes to get into a startup after 3 months. People are like very down and say it's not working. It's like 3 months is nothing. You're like, you might hit whatever. I've done thousands of investor pitches. You know, I've had thousands of people who said no to me, who think that I'm an idiot, I'm pretentious, all these kind of things, right? But how do you get through this phase? How do you keep kicking? And that, I believe, you can only go through the hoops if you have something that works for you, that deeply drives you beyond all the obstacles that are along your path. Because let's face it, a lot of people that are very good at startups could be working for another corporation, could be making massive amounts of money. I was in German government. I was a tenure when I was 24. They couldn't have fired me for the rest of my life. I could have had a good life, right? So a lot of these people are very smart, very, very ambitious. So kind of giving them a little bit of a guideline of what to expect and stay true to themselves. And I think this is what I spend a lot of time on. And I think people find it beneficial. And that's what matters.
Yeah, and I'm really curious to hear, what do you think are the kind of the things that people, if they're going to have a crazy startup and really commit to that, what do you think that they should fully be signing on for? Because like you said, a lot of people, they love the idea of, I'm going to have a tech startup, or I'm going to do a startup for 3 months and then it didn't work and I'm going back to my job. What do you think that people should really ask themselves before they commit to something like that? Like, what should they have sorted out?
I think they should look very deeply into the mirror and ask a lot of their friends and get some kind of perception of what person they are. So I try to kind of like make it now as plan-based as possible, but I try to write a questionnaire, for example, to talk about your character traits. Because, you know, if it, in my feeling, it needs to fit. If you want to be a tech startup and you know it's going to be super expensive, you better be an obnoxious dick like me. Or at least you can be, if it calls for it, right? It's not, if you need to play big leagues with venture capital, you better not be too sensitive, too easily influenced. You need to be kind of an arrogant prick. And when people ask why there's so many men, more men in tech startups than women, I said that's kind of it, because you really have to be an asshole to get there. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing, just it's a character trait that will serve you when you work in tech and big investor games, right?
Mm-hmm. What's an example of that, like where you just really have to personify that asshole energy?
I mean, first of all, you know, you're in a playing a game that is hostile by definition, and people don't understand that once you go the venture route and once you start selling shares, the opposite side has one objective, and that is being part of a fast-growing startup and optimizing their position within that company for the least amount of money possible. Right? Mm-hmm. They want to get in cheap and other people get in expensive. They want to have control and they think they know it better. And especially, you know, middle-aged male that are in venture capital that might have gotten lucky on some kind of early stage deal from whatever school friend 20 years earlier, they really think they're God's greatest gift to the world. I mean, I've never met a group of people that is so full of themselves as venture capitalists in general. I mean, they really think they know what they're doing, even though many of them literally just got lucky once in their life. And this is like, you know, having to work with people that go to the horse races and, you know, just got lucky once, but now suddenly they have all the great answers to all the questions in the world. So literally, I talked to one guy that just made a lot of money again on an A round on Spotify, and he's also a friend and he's an incredible wine seller. He said, Julian, why don't you work with venture capital anymore? I said, because I don't want to deal with assholes like you anymore. And he was like, oh, I can totally see that, right? They know they're assholes. So what an entrepreneur needs to understand, they're not out there to change the world. I mean, some of them, they're impact invest something else. But in general, they're not out there to change the world. They're out there to bet on 10 startups, kill 9, make one really successful, and take over ownership over their company. So you already have a chance of 1 in 10 to even make it, even once you make it to the venture phase, right? And then, like, the chance that you still have any equity left by the time your company is successful is, like, again, 1 out of 10. So like overall, like 1% of all the people have the meaning of building a meaningful tech startup will ever see anything in return. And so you just need to know that. You need to be a high risk gambler in order to go into there. And then there's so many other great businesses that I think can serve people so much better. Right? If you're an expert at something, you know, it's been an incredible time now where you can start your own company online on your expertise in like micro niches. If you're great at SEO, right, search engine optimization, you can run a great company on just writing f***ing meta tags these days. That would have not been possible 30 years ago. So a lot of people that I see, they're really micro entrepreneurs, and they should stick to be micro entrepreneurs because they might have one thing that they're incredibly, incredibly good at. So once these people get in a situation where they're managing 50 other people and raising money for that, and they spend all their time doing investor reports, obviously they're going to fail because they're not doing anymore what they're good at. They're doing something they're terrible at. And so I think that's a little bit of the perspective I got in for the last 10 years. I love the technology. I love the impact. But when I look back, the two things I had the least to do with was technology and impact.
Yeah.
Right? I raised money. I took a daily beating from some kind of investor anywhere. I was trying to hire people, fire people, put structures in place, teach middle management. I never got to do literally in that business what I set out to do. I was working as an advisor in investment banking in my early 20s, and I could have just gone into investment banking, right? The reason I didn't do that was because I wanted to do something meaningful with my life, and I hated investment bankers back then. What happens? I go to Africa, I want to build a machine. I spent the next decade only dealing with investment bankers. Right? It makes absolutely no sense. So, think very clearly about what kind of business you want to get into, what kind of personality you have, what kind of business that suits you for, how you can be in an environment that makes you happy. Generally, again, if you have terrible issues talking about money and you're very happy, you just want people to get along and make a positive impact, there's so many ways of doing that without having to build a venture startup company. So that's I think, a very important first step for everybody who wants to go into a business that, what makes me happy? What drives me? What do I want to achieve? And what do I have in my personality to make me strong enough for that path where I want to go?
Yeah, I have a thought-provoking question for you. Do you think that for you 12 years ago, if you could have told yourself before you started this company what you actually would have gone through for the next 12 years, do you think that you still would have started it?
I think I still would have done it. I would have done many things different on a micro level, and there are really many things I'm terrible at, and I'm, you know, the great thing about being entrepreneurs, you get to do sometimes more mistakes per day than other people do in a lifetime. your percentage of winners needs to be a little bit higher than your losers, I think, then you can stay in business. I wanted to do something really ambitious. I wanted to do something big. I wanted to do something that makes an impact. I wanted to do something that's going to be remembered, that solves real issues. And I don't think I had ever any vision or any idea that it was going to be easy. If you're building a technology product that doesn't exist yet in the world, there are only two answers to that. One is nobody wants it, or second of all, it's terribly complicated. And so for us, we built high temperature plasma reactors. If you just think about that, it just doesn't sound so easy. Like we create like a pot of volcano with not enough oxygen in it to have a full combustion, so it turns, you know, solid particles into a natural gas replacement. Did I think it was going to be easy? No. But did I think it was easy to stabilize? No. Did I think it was possible to take it from 3,000 sensors per machine to 30? So maybe if you have enough time to do that. So we're already in such uncharted territory right now. I would have probably done the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, spoken like a true life-changing entrepreneur right there. And what is really the next phase for the technology at this point? Like, what are you guys, where is the direction of the company going as far as developing this thing into actually the world-changing product?
Yeah, we had, obviously it was a big setback a year ago when we had to restructure the company. One of our investors actually bought all the assets. So we literally had to start from scratch. We had one testing unit still on the ground that we delivered offsite so we could continue our work. The first thing I need to come up with was a complete new way of funding the company. And that was the first big challenge, because we need to hire engineers, we need laboratories. I mean, we're not an app developer, we need money, right? We can't do it for free or because people want to do us a favor. It doesn't work that way. So I had to come up with a new funding strategy, which meant, first of all, reducing our costs absolutely drastically. So one example, a year ago, we spent €25,000 a month on office spaces. Right now we work out of co-working space. That's like €25,000 cut. You know, we're down from 170 people to 6. So we did massive cuts, and that allowed us to just almost be cash flow positive at this point. We don't need to make a lot of money anymore. Then we get a lot of government grants that kind of support us in our R&D, which it should be. So that works incredibly well in Germany. And then we kept making the machine smaller. I think that's a big step. We have now our smallest power generator is the size of a refrigerator. And we bought one to Bali, and people could literally carry it off the back of a truck. Which, if you could have told me that 10 years ago, that we're going to build a power plant that can be carried, I thought this is just never going to happen.
Well, here in Bali, people will be putting them on the back of a scooter too and driving them around. You know? I've seen a refrigerator on the back of a scooter.
Exactly. I mean, somebody will try sooner or later. So what's really nice for us is we've come up with a completely new generation. Obviously, then this year we had to do a lot of new patent work and also some new designs in order not to infringe our own patents that we've had in the past. It's a little painful if you, I think I've done 5 patents myself on that. Now I can't use any of them. So we kind of had to go back to the drawing board, come up with a new machine. Now it's at that point again where it has done the first successful field tests, for example, in India for Tata and Rockefeller Foundation. So there's going to be a project with 10,000 machines all over India. It's going to make a massive socio-economic impact. I think it's a project I'm truly going to be proud of. And now we're back in the laboratory, and we work in 2 international research clusters, and everybody brings their own waste. And then we run it through the machines and see when it's going to blow up. That's kind of where we stand right now. And so far, we've not been able to blow it up. So we're working on a project even with the University of Singapore. We're doing like literally unsorted municipal waste and try to run it through the machines. And so far, it looks very, very positive. And then we're probably going to bring that machine, you know, depending on what fuel is for, to markets like early 2021 with some pilot units. Already 5 right now in the world, 1 Dominican Republic, 1 in Japan, 1 in India, 1 in Bali, and 1 in Germany. And so we're like going to do a little target project for the customers we work with, most of the time big international global corporations that are supporting us. And try to bring that thing to market as quickly, but at the same time as safely as possible. And I think then you're going to hear quite a lot about it. It's like really the old idea of Back to the Future, a little bit before your time, when we remember the movie.
I remember. I was pretty young when that was circulating around, but... Yeah,
it's a very, very similar idea, and I think the problem has not changed. I mean, that's the great thing. If you really tackle something big, even if it takes you 10 years longer than you anticipated, the problem is now probably more relevant than it has ever been before. More people are talking about it, and to a certain extent, we probably were just 10 years ahead of our time, to be quite honest. Because now everybody wants to have an impact. Everybody talks about plastic waste. When I did that 12 years ago, just really nobody cared. It was not an issue.
Yeah, well, like you said, it's becoming more and more of an issue. Like, I was living in the Philippines for 4 months last year, and there's a lot of places there that literally the beaches are just completely covered in garbage, like just totally covered in plastic, because the locals there, they often will use single-use plastic all the time. They just throw it on the grounds, and then it goes into the rivers, goes into the oceans, and it accumulates on the beaches. And it's really sad to see that in such a beautiful place like the Philippines. But like, it's a problem that's only going to continue stacking. You know, plastic doesn't just decompose itself and, exactly. and go away. Right?
Waste needs to be treated. Otherwise, waste will not go away by itself. And I think slowly people are getting... Just putting on a landfill somewhere, especially in Southeast Asia, just makes no sense, because we have, you know, a strong rainy season here. So people pile this up and there's like no protection layer to it. So, you know, you got some strong wind, some wrong rain, and it just all ends up back in the ocean. And there's like a never ending cycle. And like an island like Bali is not going to build a 500 million waste to energy plant. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So other
and
solutions
it's already, like,
are
burning, and, you know, polluting the air. Like, I have lots of digital nomad friends who are living in Chiang Mai, but then burning season, as they call it over there, Chiang Mai turns to, I think, the number one worst air quality of any city in the world for a certain period of time, like worse than Shenzhen and these crazy like manufacturing cities in China, right? Which is pretty startling to hear.
Yeah, but it's got the same thing here as well. People take their rice crops after they're done harvesting and they put them on a pile, and then they add the plastic that was somewhere caught, you know, around, and they set the whole thing on fire. And a straw in itself doesn't even really burn. It smolders. And it's wet, and you have need like one pile like this going to smoke up the entire village. And we have that. We live right in the rice fields. We have that all the time. And I really don't want to know, particle-wise, how many cancerogenic particles are in those open burning pits that we have here all the time. So, I mean, I think the people are aware of the problem now. And that's why I said we need to finish this thing up now. We're so close. We know that we can take the agriculture waste that they have. We can put it in the machine. And we can burn it in a clean way that's carbon negative, that you can use in as useful energy, there's heat or electricity. So we can't stop now. We just need to finish up the technology, give it to the people.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly intrigued to see where this goes. And kind of coming to the end of our time here, my last question for you, you touched on this a little bit before, but I'd like to know, for all of the listeners who, there's a lot of people listening for sure that they want to do something that's game-changing for the world and just work on something like this that they truly believe in, seeing the change that the company creates. What advice do you have for someone like that who's just looking for that game-changing, the world-changing thing they can work on but just hasn't really found the right opportunity yet?
Again, what I work strongly with entrepreneurs is clarify their vision. And make it as clearly and easily understandable for anyone else. Because in my feeling, my experience, you cannot go that way alone. If you really want to do something that is you know, going to change the world, you're going to need a lot of people to make sacrifices for you, right? You're going to need investors, you need to have people that come work for you, you need people that support you, you need like a grassroots movement, you know, you need to convince people, you need to talk to the press. There's so many things that need to be done along that pathway. So I think the best thing you can do as an entrepreneur, if you really want to make a difference, is make your vision as clear as possible. It's like, it continuously people that pitch to me and tell me their story, and I just don't get it. I see their passion, I understand what they want to do, but I'm not really clear that they know how to do it or what they're actually trying to fix. And if you're not clear, it gets very, very difficult for anyone else to support you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, anybody that's looking to do something meaningful with their life is either, you know, join a course that's already out there, or, you know, be very, very clear and very precise as how you're going to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it will simply get very complicated for anybody else to follow you along that way, because simply nobody will understand you.
Very, very well said. Well, Julian, this has been absolutely a pleasure to talk to you about this. Is some really incredible stuff that you have gone through in your entrepreneurial career, and I'm sure that this is just the beginning here from the sounds of it. If people want to follow along with your company, what you guys are doing, where's the best place for them to do that?
Well, I'm 43 years old. I just became a grandfather, actually, but I'm quite proud. I have a decently working Instagram campaign. So it's hashtag Julian Uhlich, JulienUhlig. I also have my own podcast on iTunes and Spotify called The Resilient Entrepreneur, which we just talked about. And my personal website also is julienuhlich.co. And I'm at a point in my life where I everything I do kind of blends together. Like, yes, we still, of course, have companies, we raise money, but it's all kind of runs under my own name. It's like my passion website. Everything I do, from making music to building technology startups to teaching entrepreneurs, is all in one place. So if you find me, Julian Ulich, I'm pretty easy to be found at Google.
Awesome. Well, really appreciate you coming on here and sharing everything.
My pleasure.
So vulnerably with the audience here. And guys, if you're looking for any of the show notes, you can find those on dannycarlson.co. Any of the links and resources that Julian mentioned here is going to be there. And if you haven't already, go leave a review on iTunes, on Stitcher. Really appreciate every single review. I read all of them and get a big smile on my face whenever I hear you guys' feedback. So made it really easy for you guys too. You guys can go to ratethispodcast.com/dan/DAN. And it just opens up the app on your whatever phone, whatever app you got on there, and can easily leave a review. So really appreciate it, guys. Until next time, go and kick some ass.
Thanks for joining us on the Danny Carlson Podcast. For resources mentioned in this episode, visit dannycarlson.co.